You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Before Tim McCarver became one of baseball's premier television analysts, and personally I think he is the best, he spent 21 years as a major league catcher, mostly with the St. Louis Cardinals and Philadelphia Phillies. He's won six Emmy Awards over almost three decades as a sportscaster for both New York teams and the Major League National telecast on Fox. And he's the host of his own syndicated sports show. And he's also written a number of books. The most recent one, Tim McCarver's Diamond Gems, Favorite Baseball Stories from the Legends of the Game, draws on the full range of his half century of baseball experience. It is published by McGraw-Hill. And I'm very pleased that it has brought Tim McCarver back to the show today. Hello.
Leonard, how are you?
And you've got to forgive me. We will talk a lot about the book. But before we get to it, can we talk just for a moment about the trades that happened yesterday?
Absolutely.
Manny Ramirez, who was unhappy with the Red Sox, was traded right before the end of the trade deadline to the Los Angeles Dodgers. Do you think he'll be happier in Los Angeles where he'll get a lot of media attention?
I think he will be happy because he's out of Boston. I think the Red Sox will be equally, if not happier than Manny because Manny is out of Boston. But the key thing with his production is it's his contract year. And he has 2 months of bliss with the Dodgers, who are contending in the National League West. And he has the opportunity to play for Joe Torre, who is a master at handling situations like this.
Although Torre is reputed to not admire him too much. Maybe that's because of the old Yankee Red Sox thing.
I think
when a guy comes on your team, a guy you hated for years and years, suddenly can help you, he becomes a wonderful person suddenly.
I don't know if his character changes, but I think the character of your club could change from an effective standpoint. The thing about Manny Ramirez is he could hit, but things had gotten to be untenable in New England. And, to name several things, he shoved and pushed to the floor the traveling secretary who could not get him 16 tickets in Tampa Bay to a baseball game. He refused to play two games last Wednesday and Friday. Friday in particular against the Yankees with the mysterious knee ailment. The Red Sox shrewdly sent him to the hospital for MRIs. They showed nothing. And they forced him to play in a game that Joe Buck and I did for Fox last Saturday. So
Manny being Manny.
Manny being Manny is one of the great cop-out sayings in the history of sports.
But do you think the Dodgers needed to do something dramatic to attract fans who are obviously all excited by the play of the Los Angeles Angels this year?
I don't think that had anything to do with it. I think it's an upgrade for the Dodgers team against Arizona.
In a weak division.
In a very weak division. Arizona's two games up on the Dodgers. They won last night. They have a four-game series in Los Angeles now. But the Angels are the best team in baseball.
Although they used to be the California Angels. Now they're the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim.
Right.
The Devil Rays improved when they were renamed the Rays. So do you think changing the team name is the latest winning strategy in baseball?
That's very well put, and perhaps that's the case. The Devil Rays were changed to the Rays last winter. And the Angels changed their name a couple of years ago. But the Angels are, interestingly, and I just found this out this morning from my broadcast partner of next week, Tom Brenneman, who said that the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim have made three coaching changes in the last 9 years. Mike Socha has been the manager during that time. Bobby Ramos and Joe Maddon went to Tampa Bay, and Bud Black went to the San Diego Padres as their manager. Those are the only changes that have been made, and that proves that they are a solid, solid group of people and manage very, very well.
I have a friend who believes that teams sometimes don't improve themselves even when they upgrade their personnel because consistency is also a major factor.
Well, consistency.
He was talking about basketball, actually, because there it's just five guys. But still, you know, after a while, you learn another player's tendencies, don't you?
Well, consistency from management is as important as consistency from the players. Because if you get consistent management who make right decisions year in and year out, you're going to get the right players and the right blend of players. Torrey Hunter, who came to the Angels from the Minnesota Twins last year, is an example of the type player. He's a real winner, and it's been a real upgrade for the Angels.
Let's talk about the book now. It's called Tim McCarver's Diamond Gems, Favorite Baseball Stories from the Legends of the Game. Where did the stories come from?
They came from my television show. You mentioned the national show. It's a compilation of the shows. And we decided that the shows were so good that to allow them to just be out there was not the way to blend them into perpetuity, if you will. So we decided to compile some of the stories, and they're wonderful stories about, as an example, I mean, Earl Weaver, the Hall of Fame manager, most people don't know that when he was a child, he carried the dry cleaning of his father into the clubhouse at Old Sportsman's Park in St. Louis. And when he was 13, 14 years old, he thought by delivering these uniforms that you can imagine for a teenager like that, what kind of future he deemed himself. Well, he never became a good player, but he did sign with the Cardinals and, of course, became a Hall of Fame manager with the Baltimore Orioles, winning several titles back in the 70s. And it's those types of stories that, you know, everybody can see hitters that hit well, hitters that hit with power, base runners that with blinding speed. But it's the behind-the-scenes story. Mookie Wilson, during the strike in 1981, Mookie was a very popular Mets player. It was his first year, and he was making the minimum. And naturally, the strike not only hurt the owners, but it hurt a lot of the players, too. And Mookie used to eat at this restaurant in Queens, and the owner of the restaurant called him the second day of the strike and asked Mookie if he'd like to be the maitre d' for 2 months. So Mookie, William Hayward Wilson, became the maitre d' at this Queens restaurant for the 2 months that the players were on strike.
These days, players seem very good at giving reporters sound bites. They say things like, one game at a time, 110%, everyone puts his pants on one leg at a time. How do you get past that?
Well, I think cliches are around because they're oh so true. I mean, you have to. I think players are better at that in expressing themselves now, because they're more exposed to television, they're more exposed to sound bites. They're better at even than they were 10 years ago. And I mentioned Torrey Hunter earlier. You talk about a guy who lights up a television camera. We had a chance to get those sound bites, similar sound bites that you were talking about, and to see a guy from Pine Bluff, Arkansas, to get away from the cliches and to light up a television camera is a real treat for somebody in the business.
But you say you don't think it's necessary to push them beyond their comfort zone. If you get them to be comfortable and allow them to say that sort of thing, then they eventually will open up.
I found that to be true, Leonard, yes.
Now, on the other hand, there are some players, no matter what you do, it's going to be like pulling teeth. I remember watching painful interviews with Paul O'Neill, for example.
The ever-present, you know, from athletes. No, we don't know. Or as Gene Locklear told Al Michaels once during an interview back in the 70s, he said Al had him on live for a post-game interview. And Al asked him a rather tough question, and Gene said, just between you and me, Al? I mean, you know, you've got millions of people listening. So I told him something, thinking that it was just between Al and
this
himself.
Is off the record.
Off the record, right. It's live, but off the record.
But there are some that you have the other side, too. You have some people who are incredibly outspoken, and you just you may even worry for them because they're saying things that are outrageous.
Well, there are ways to control that. A lot of times now, you know, with sound bites, you don't really, I mean, those things would be edited. But if after the game you catch a player in a heated moment, I remember Chad Curtis, who was very upset at NBC's treatment of Pete Rose back in 99 or 2000, who refused to give an on-field interview after the World Series to Jim Gray, because Jim Gray had been the announcer who had talked. I thought it was terribly unfair, but sometimes that's, you get the reactions of players. But it can be very volatile at times if it's live, no question.
What about Pete Rose? Should he be forgiven? I mean, I'm right now I'm watching the Barry Bonds saga play out, and I have to believe that pretty much every team in baseball could use Barry Bonds right now, and yet you know nobody's going to sign him. Obviously, deal has been made.
I don't think he's going to sign, and I don't think he should sign. I think the baggage is too great, particularly at this late date. I mean, here we are in August. But the other issue of Pete Rose is the Hall of Fame as to, you know, Pete Rose lied about gambling. Had he said initially that I gambled, I made a mistake, please forgive me, I don't think there is any question that Pete Rose would have been reinstated. He lied and then finally came out with a book that he upon which he got, what, $1 million advance, and said in the book, that okay, I didn't bet against the Cincinnati Reds. I bet for them. That's just as bad. And the one thing you cannot do in baseball is gamble, and that's why I do not think Pete Rose,
even though he holds so many records, and was one of the great players.
Oh, more hits than anybody in the history of the game, and a man that that worked and toiled for his money. And I don't think anybody. I played with Pete 1 year, my last full year. In the major leagues was Pete's first year with the Philadelphia Phillies, and he was an extraordinary player. But I don't think he'll get in the Hall of Fame, nor do I think he deserves it.
You organize the book by position. Do people play different? Are there different personality types at different positions?
No question about it.
I mean, there are even subcategories like lefty pitchers.
Yes, yes. They're you know, pitchers are perhaps the most eccentric of all athletes, with the exception maybe of tennis players. I just thought about that. But pitchers initiate the action in baseball, and they have eccentric personalities. I said that once on the air when I was working for the New York Mets, and Fred Wilpon, who was the owner of the Mets and still is, was a left-handed pitcher in high school, and he was very offended by me saying that pitchers were eccentric. I said, that doesn't mean that they're bad. It just means that they're different. And they're different for a reason, because they, as I said, initiate the action and are alone on the mound when they make the decision along with their catch.
They're in the highest pressure position on the field.
I think so.
I mean, only the batter is feeling as much pressure. Maybe the pitcher has more pressure.
I think that that's the case. And there, from a psychological standpoint, and interestingly, I've always found it interesting that he's isolated on that little that bump, as the players call it, the bump in the infield, which is the pitcher's mound. But they're fascinating people, and Tom Seaver's an example of a man who shows his eccentricities. Tom, when his playing career was over, he couldn't wait to buy some land in California, and now has 3.5 acres where he grows wine. And I recently interviewed him, and I've tasted the wine. It's terrific wine, and I will even go so far as to say the wine is as good as Tom Seaver was as a pitcher.
Wow,
that's how good the wine is. But it fits. It makes sense.
Because he was a perfectionist as a pitcher.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
My guest is Tim McCarver, whose latest book is Tim McCarver's Diamond Gems. It has a foreword by George Will, and it is published by McGraw-Hill. We will continue our conversation after this. I'm talking with Tim McCarver, who was a major league catcher from 1959 to 1980 and the World Series MVP in 1964 when he was with the St. Louis Cardinals. He's a six-time Emmy winner, and he has among his television – well, he not only does a lot of television, he also has written a number of books, the most recent Tim McCarver's Diamond Games, Favorite Baseball Stories from the Legends of the Game, published by McGraw-Hill. We were talking about pitchers. Yusuhiro Nakasone, who's a former prime minister of Japan, once said that ideally in any government you have a pitcher and a catcher relationship. The pitcher is the politician and the catcher is the bureaucrat. Do you find that insulting to be thought of as a baseball bureaucrat?
That's an interesting comment.
Because it also implies that the pitcher is creative and
yes.
the dynamic half of the thing, and the catcher is an enforcer. And most catchers will tell you that what they do is very creative.
I caught Bob Gibson for the better part of his career and the better part of my career. We started together in the early 60s, and I was traded in 1969 with Curt Flood from the Cardinals, and then I rejoined Bob in 1973 and '74. He retired in 1975. And Bob's from Omaha. And he's a good friend of Warren Buffett's. And at one time, Warren Buffett asked Bob a question. He said, "Did McCarver call the game or did you call the game?" And Bob, offended as only Bob can do, feigning offense, said, "Warren, Tim just suggested pitches. I threw them." And so I ended up writing Buffett a letter. I sent him a copy of my book. This was 10 years ago. And Warren sent a very nice letter back. But that's an example.
Well, he supposedly said to you when you came out to the mound, is this apocryphal? Don't talk to me. The only thing you know about pitching is that you can't hit it.
That is not apocryphal. That is a true story. And I went for 3 or 4 years without going out to the mound to talk to Bob.
You were intimidated by him, or you just felt it was useless?
I didn't want the trouble. Our manager, Johnny Keene, used to say, "You've got to go out and slow him down." And I said, "John, if you want him slowed down, you slow him down. I'm not going out there. I'm not going to be offended anymore by any Gibson remarks." In fact, Bob Gibson was the most difficult friend. I think I've told you this before. He was the most difficult friend that I've ever had. He didn't particularly like me when we first started playing together. I didn't particularly like him. He's one of my closest friends now. But you have to earn his friendship, just like you have to earn his loyalty behind the plate in suggesting a game.
Well, what does that mean if the catcher doesn't know exactly what the pitcher is going to do? And we've seen this happen every once in a while. The catcher moves outside, the pitch is low and in the dirt inside, and it can lead to real problems.
One of the myths in baseball is that a catcher's primary responsibility is to learn the hitters. You know the hitters like that. There's nothing to learning a hitter's weakness. You know whether he's a low ball hitter, a high ball hitter, he likes the ball inside or outside. You could sit behind a guy for 4 at-bats and find that out. The emphasis should always be put on the pitcher and his strengths, not the hitter and his weaknesses. If it perchance is the same, if the weaknesses and the pitcher's strength are the same, then you're going to get the hitter out more often than not.
Is there a problem with focus? The ball field is rife with distractions, isn't it? Fans, coaches, pretty women in the stands. And in ball four, Jim Bouton made it clear that ball players spend a fair amount of time concentrating on those attractive women in the stands.
Infielders and outfielders do. Pitchers and catchers don't. Pitchers have a tunnel vision in picking up a catcher. And the catcher really has the panoply of the whole field at his peripheral vision, so you know that may be the case between and among infielders and outfielders, but not pitchers and catchers.
Many people think that Sandy Koufax only became a great pitcher when his catcher of the time, Norm Sherry, advised him that 95 miles per hour could strike out batters just as easily as 100 miles per hour.
Instead of picking up the glove, pick up the four corners, the two shoulders and the two knees. That's what Norm Sherry convinced Sandy of, and Sandy corroborated that. In fact, that's in the book.
But nobody remembers Norm Sherry anymore.
No, but Sandy does. And that's the only guy that's important. I remember when I was a junior in high school, Bill Dickey, the great Yankee catcher, number 8, was a scout for the New York Yankees. I came very close to signing with the Yankees in 1959 out of high school. And Bill Dickey handed me a list of things for a catcher to go through in handling pitchers. Most were foreign to me, but one thing that stood out was always be a pitcher's friend, and in the process, do all the things a friend would do, whether it's admonishing him or being his best friend at the time or going out to dinner, whatever it took. But it was an interesting list of things.
Well, I don't want to only focus on catchers, but just one more thing. We were talking about personalities at different positions, and catchers seem to make pretty good managers and pretty good broadcasters.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is? Are they gregarious?
I think being gregarious is one thing, but I think, as I mentioned, the field is in their view. No other player has the view of all positions like the catcher does. Even a center fielder, he's blind to the right fielder and left fielder, to his flanks. But the catcher has everybody. And unknowingly, what you're doing as you're playing the position, you're learning the other positions. You're seeing the jumps that they get. I can, in my mind's eye, I can see Curt Flood taking 3 steps into right center field with a right-handed hitter on pitches away, watching to where I would set up, getting an extra jump on the ball. So you know it. So from a manager standpoint, it's easier to convey that when you become a manager. And from a broadcaster standpoint, you have the same view when you become a broadcaster.
Did you ever consider going into coaching and managing? Gary Carter is still bitter that he hasn't made it to the major leagues as a manager.
I think that's probably true.
I know it is because he talked about it more than once on the show. We talked about it, and then he came back to it. It's obviously something that bothers him a lot.
Yes. I had an opportunity to manage later in my career as a broadcaster, but I was so firmly entrenched as a broadcaster that it was really too late. And now at my age, I do not even consider going back on the field.
My guest is Tim McCarver, whose latest book is Tim McCarver's Diamond Gems, Favorite Baseball Stories from the Legends of the Game, published by McGraw-Hill. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And you, these stories, as you said, were told to you on your TV show. Why do you think you got some of these intimate stories? Were you surprised by some of the things that people told you?
I think so. A lot of humorous things that were told to me. Johnny Bench, for instance, said that he went back to his hometown of Binger, Oklahoma, after the World Series in 1975, and they had a parade for him. And Binger, Oklahoma is and was a very small town. And I said, Why was no one there? Johnny said no one was there. And he said, well, everybody was in the parade. And so therefore, there were no people there. I thought it was hilarious. And you mentioned Gary Carter. I mean, Gary Carter was in the middle of his career, had a storybook moment at Shea Stadium. His first game with the New York Mets, when he came over, there were four players that were traded for him for the 1985 season. In his first game, an extra inning game in the 10th inning, I remember doing the play-by-play with Ralph Kiner and Steve Zabriskie. And Gary Carter hit a game-winning home run against Neil Allen. Now, this is game one. A lot of expectations for the Mets. Dwight Gooden was 20 years old. Darryl Strawberry in his second full year with the Mets. And Ralph Kiner had him on his Kiner's corner at the end of the game and referred to Gary Carter seven times as Gary Cooper. And Gary Cooper with the game winning hit. I mean, these are classic moments in baseball. They're just wonderful things, and capture them, as I tried to do in the book, is wonderful.
But Ralph Kiner is a great broadcaster. Oh, but he was wonderful. Famous for his little mistakes of that sort. But he also told you a wonderful story about Babe Ruth, because this is one of the interesting things here is that we still have people in the game who remember when the game was very different.
Ralph had several stories about Babe Ruth, but if I may go to someone else concerning Ralph Kiner. It's not in the book, but it was on my show. I had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on the show. I don't know if you've ever met him, Leonard.
He's been on the show a couple of times.
Isn't he a fascinating man? And I found him extraordinary. He not only was a Hall of Fame, one of the great basketball players in the history of the game, but he really knows baseball. He knows it very well. And he said that he was in the Negro Museum in Kansas City, and he ran into the catcher of Satchel Paige. And Satchel Paige, and the catcher for Satchel Paige, told him a story about Ralph Kiner. And I'm wondering where this is going. And when Ralph was 17 years old, Satchel Paige was pitching against him in a barnstorming game in Southern California. Ralph had a home run against Satchel his first time up. And Satchel called his catcher out there who told Jabbar the story. And he said, "Who is that guy?" And he said, "Well, he's a young phenom. His name is Ralph Kiner." And he said, "You let me know the next time he comes up." As though Satchel wouldn't know. So the next time before Kiner came up, the catcher came to the mound, and Satchel said, "I'm going to throw this man three pitches. I'm going to throw him a pee at the knee, a taste at the waist, and it's going to be better at the letters." He struck Ralph out on three pitches, at the knee, at the waist, and at the letters. And that's one of the great stories told by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to me about Ralph Kiner. Now, it does not get any better than that.
Well, you don't include yourself in this book because these are stories that were told to you, but you do wind up in the book in a story that Mike Schmidt told. He talked about hitting home runs off of the pitches that you called as a catcher.
I called his first home run off Baylor Moore in September of 1972. And the next year was Mike Schmidt's first full year. And Mike had not had a hit. He had a knee problem in spring training. I, at the time, was with the St. Louis Cardinals. I was traded back to the Cardinals. And Mike laid down a bunt with two out and nobody on. Well, with two out and nobody on, if you bunt for a base hit, you're really doing it for yourself and not to help the team. So that antagonizes not only your team and your manager, but the other team. And I mean, I stood on the top step and was screaming at Mike and was upset about it. And there were a lot of other Cardinals. And this caused a lot of bad blood because Schmidt was such a young player and everything. And we ultimately had, Ken Brett was a pinch runner later on in the season, and he ran over me at home plate. And primarily it was for some of the things that I had said to Schmidt that day. But Mike didn't forget it. I didn't forget it. And we became teammates and the best of friends for 5 years with the Philadelphia Phillies.
Well, do you remember everything that happened? I interviewed Keith Hernandez once, and we talked about an at-bat, and he said, well, he the first pitch was a curveball low and away, and mm-hmm. then I said, mm-hmm. he described every pitch, and I asked him, do you remember every pitch that was thrown to you? He said, most of them. Is that possible?
Well, it's true, Leonard.
Are you that focused?
Well, you're that focused, and there's something, I don't know what it is about the mind that allows you to remember as much as you remember. From a player standpoint, because I can't remember the things from situation standpoint nearly as much as an announcer as I did as a player. 20 years ago as an announcer is not nearly as fresh as 40 years ago as a player. So it must be something about the mind that zeroes in and focuses.
And do you remember mostly the good stuff? I mean, you're a two-time All-Star. You were a World Series MVP. You caught a no-hitter. But you also
caught two no-hitters.
And you also hit a Grand Slam single.
I did. I hit the 200th anniversary of our country, July 4th, 1976. And I recently told my partner, Joe Buck, on the air that I did it for our country. But I passed the runner at first base with the bases loaded on a home run, and I didn't even know the rule. And I was given credit for a grand slam single. So,
and
so
then were you broadcasting the Mets games when Robin Ventura did that?
No, I was not. No, that was during a playoff game, and he was credited with that. I think as a walk off home run or something like that. I think they ought to change that rule. I don't think passing a runner is important, because once the ball's out of the ballpark,
the game is over anyway.
So I think that rule should be changed.
Are you going to be sad when Yankee Stadium is torn down? I'm sure
yes.
You're not going to be sad when Shea Stadium is torn down.
No. No, you're right on both counts.
I'm a Mets fan, but
yes.
I'm sorry
Shea
to see
to
Yankee Stadium go, because it's so historic, and it's actually still a pretty nice ballpark.
Yes, it is. It is, and they take immaculate care of it. And the Mets do what they can with Shea Stadium, but, I mean, it was old when it was new, when it was built back in 1964.
I think the only person who really will miss Shea Stadium is Chipper Jones.
I think he'll adapt to Citi Field.
So now the trading deadline is over.
Yes.
And the serious stuff begins.
I mean,
nobody can predict.
Phenomenal trade. So, I mean, the Yankees get Pudge Rodriguez after getting Xavier Nady and Domasil Marte last weekend. The Chicago White Sox get Ken Griffey Jr. And as we said earlier, Manny Ramirez goes to the Dodgers. Since the trading deadline moved from June 15th to July 31st, I can think of no other time where three potential, not potential, guys that are going to be in the Hall of Fame, Rodriguez, Griffey, and Ramirez, were traded at the July 31st trading deadline. It's exceptional.
A-Rod told the newspapers today that it's not really important what he does in his personal life. You think that ballplayers should be given a pass?
Well,
or are they such big celebrities these days that we care whether they have been faithful in their marriage?
I don't care. Doesn't matter to me. I don't care what they do. The game between the lines is, to me,
And he'll make it into the Hall of Fame.
Alex Rodriguez?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think you should be in the Hall of Fame, Tim. You've done some pretty good stuff.
I've done some pretty good stuff, but that's an exclusive. I was not good enough for the Hall of Fame, but I'm glad to be in a business where I can listen to guys who are Hall of Famers, and I can listen to them with respect and with their respect, to have them open up and tell some of the stories that they've told me.
And many of them are included in this book, Tim McCarver's Diamond Gems, Favorite Baseball Stories from the Legends of the Game, published by McGraw-Hill. Thank you so much for being with us again.
I've enjoyed it so much, as always, Leonard. Thank you.